Today I'm going to talk about something that that is related to my work. That's in my work with Nima Arkani Hamid and Yuting Huang on the EFT Hedron. And I only talk about a part of the paper which I find interesting. And here's the plan for today's talk. I'll first give a very brief introduction on the problem that we're trying to tackle. And next, I'll talk about the geometries mentioned in the title of this talk that result from physical requirements on the UV completed amplitude. Then I'll combine those geometries to form a geometrical object we call the EFT hedron. And this will be, in this talk, the EFT hedron given will be a very toy model version of it. There are many caveats, some of which are discussed in our paper. I won't be talking about them here for the sake of clarity. And finally, I'll give a brief summary of my talk. So we know that the UV information comes into the IR observable through the form of higher dimensional coupling. So if you don't know anything about the UV theory, you can still go and measure IR observables, and the measurement or the Wilson coefficients will depend on how exactly your UV physics and the UV interactions are. So if on the other hand you already have the UV completed theory and you want to compute how you're going to see things in the low energy theory, then you can integrate out the states that's above some mass scale that you set to produce IR couplings. And it's long observed and known by people that if you just write down a naive effective field theory with a bunch of higher dimensional operators that's consistent with your symmetry, and you assign them arbitrary coefficients, then not all of them are going to you won't be able to find a weakly coupled UV completion to some of the theories that you write down in this way. And the reason for that is manifold, some of which has to do with causality requirements, for example, the propagation of certain waves on some background, or some of which has to do with unitarity. And today we're going to discuss how the requirement of unitarity and analyticity is constraining your IR effective field theory. And we'll be using the dispersion relation to connect the IR coefficient, IR EFT couplings to the UV data. So here I'm writing a contour integral of a scattering amplitude at some fixed t, and over, and the contour is around the origin. And we're assuming that at sufficiently low energy, the amplitude can be approximated in this IR form where you have some masses interaction or possibly some very low mass interaction corresponding to the state that you can observe in the IR. But for simplicity, we won't be discussing them here. And then there will be some polynomials in the Mendelstein variables that are produced by the derivative coupling in your effective field theory. And through the, if we deform the contour in the in this expression, then the contribution becomes the residues and discontinuities of your amplitude in a region outside of your applicability of effective field theory, and possibly some contribution at infinity. So this will be contour of the same quantity at infinity. But through a proper choice of n here, we can assume that this term will not contribute. Then the this dispersion relation connects the information about residue and discontinuity of the loop amplitude to our to our Wilson coefficient in the IREFT. So we want to utilize this fact. And the first thing we are going to do is to use the so-called Gegenbauer positivity. So here I take the Mess's 4-point superstring amplitude as an example, where you have this beta function form that that captures the kinematic information, and then there are some polarization dependent term, but this will not be important for our purpose. So let's look at the kinematic prefactor, and let's take the residue of that prefactor as some massive pole. So if you take the residue in the S channel, the resulting expression will be a polynomial in T, and the degree of that polynomial will depend on which residue that you are looking at. But the important thing is that it's a polynomial, and here, because we're essentially just discarding the polarization vector dependence, we can think of it as a scalar, four scalar scattering through some massive hair spin intermediate state. And taking residue means that we're looking at the unshelled contribution to this, meaning that your 4-point amplitude factorizes into two pieces of 3-point amplitudes. And the intermediate state here will be some massive higher spin state. And it's known that if you pick a definite spin here for your intermediate particle, then the contribution of this product to the residue is captured by this Gegenbauer polynomial, which is a polynomial in T of degree J, of degree equal to your spin. And it depends on the spatial dimension that your theory is living in. So let's try to expand the residue that we get from string theory on this polynomial basis. And because the polynomial basis itself depends on the space-time dimension, the resulting coefficient will also depend on space-time dimension. And if you're scattering identical particles, for example, four identical scalars here, then you expect this this expansion coefficient to be non-negative, simply because it's coming from the square of the 3-point couplings from your factorization. So this puts a bound on the possible dimensions that your theory can live in while still have integrity. And that's not what we're going to use in our paper. We're not trying to put our theory on arbitrary space-time dimension, but we're trying to do similar thing. Namely, we're trying to expand a residue of some amplitude, 4-point amplitude on a polynomial basis. And we are trying to see how the positivity of the coefficient in the expansion is constraining the 4-point amplitude. So the simplest thing we can do along this direction is to just take the 4 limit, namely in this case, setting T to be 0. Then because the Gegenbauer polynomials at T at 1 is a positive number, this means that your residue at 4 limit must be a sum of positive numbers, meaning a non-negative sum of positive numbers, which are just positive. So that we already know from various old references. But here we can, because we know the polynomial must be some very spatial orthogonal polynomials, we can expand the polynomial around the 4 limit. So we can think of the old 4 limit bound as the zeroth order result from this positivity. And if we expand this polynomial around the argument 1, and the zeroth order will be just setting T to be 0. The first order will be the derivative from T. And then after that, you set T to be 0. So you can do this indefinitely. And if we just consider, for example, the first two derivatives along with the zeroth order result, and for each spin, you can get some numerical coefficients from this expansion. So this will be spin 0, spin 1, spin 2, da, da, da. So this tells you that the residue of your amplitude, if expanded around 4 limit to the second order, must be written as, you must be able to write it as a positive summation of the following form, where you have some CI that's non-negative or just positive if there is a interaction for it. And there will be numbers that comes from the Gegenbauer polynomial, or in this case, I actually set the space-time dimension to be 3 plus 1. So it's just the Legendre polynomial. But in general, you can play the same game for the Gegenbauer polynomial, which are d-dimensional variant of the Legendre polynomial. But one thing that's preventing us from getting useful bound is the fact that those numbers are accompanied by a factor of 1 over mass square. And this mass is the particle that's being exchanged when you take the amplitude on shell. So depending on the mass, you may get different vectors from each spin. And it looks that we cannot have very clean statement about it. But we'll see that if we organize the coefficient in a certain way, then you can still say something about it. So let's postpone the discussion of Gegenbauer positivity for now. And let's instead look at another direction.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So in general, these derivatives on the forward limit are divergent. Because there are logs.
Yes.
Can you comment a little bit on that?
You mean the logs coming from the masses from it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in this paper, we discussed the masses running in the last section. And for the mass, for the case where you actually have the masses loop, because of the masses loop, the dispersion relation are no longer valid. And you, also, it's not clear what your IR effective couplings mean. So you must have some regularized version of the dispersion relation that includes a scale. It's similar to the massive regulator to IR divergent quantity, but it's not exactly the same. So that's the subtlety that's accompanying the massive loop case. Here, I just assume that we are not we don't have to worry about such contributions. But you are right that if there are massive loops, then the naive dispersion relation that I just wrote down cannot possibly work.
So let me understand. We are scattering massless particles, right?
Yes.
So there will be massless loops.
Yes. So in particular, I'm thinking about the contribution from integrating out massive higher spin states to such amplitude. And if we want to do things honestly, we should start from the beginning, just use the masses regulated version of the dispersion relation to define everything, to define our effective couplings. In particular, this term here will depend on the coupling, the mass scale that we are regulating our masses theory. But for the sake of introducing the geometries, I'm refraining from doing that. But you can ask me more about this after I finish the discussion on the geometries, or you can also refer to the masses discussion section of the EFT Hedron paper.
Yeah, so I'm just asking if, can it be that these shifts are divergent and therefore when you say something is positive, but then if you have to shift it by an infinite amount, is it still meaningful?
So after you define the mass regulated version of the IR divergent quantity, you can still play the same game of the geometries that I'm going to describe here. And the resulting thing will have some definite positivity as well.
I agree, but it will depend on the mass, right? When the mass goes to 0, these walls can be sent to infinity, right?
If the mass goes to 0, you really shouldn't be using the boundaries that I'm talking about here because they're only well-defined for the massive intermediate contributions. But if you do the mass regulation, then the boundaries will have an inherent dependence on the mass regulator, and there won't be any divergence or, yeah.
Maybe I can ask a different question. What kind of theories this works for? And what's the physics of this mass regulator in those theories?
You mean the IR regulation? So for example, in the appendix, we can consider a version of the linear sigma model, and then you can consider the four-point amplitudes where there are some masses internal loops that cause the running of your IR couplings. So there will be some the tree level result plus the log divergence that you talk about coming from the masses loops. So there will be one example. And if you consider the regulated couplings in that theory, then the Legendre positivity and the Hankel positivity that I'm going to talk about still holds in some sense. But I haven't really told you about what those positivities are. So maybe we can talk about that.
Let's postpone.
Yeah. So as I said, there will be two kind of positivities that we can derive from this positive requirement in the UV data. And I'm going to discuss the first of them. So let's consider, for example, the propagator written in the Keller-Lehmann representation, which are basically just an integral over the spectral density times the Bayer propagator. In particular, this spectral density must be non-negative. Then if you expand around small s, then you can arrive at this kind of series expansion where each of the the coefficient in front of each power in S is will have this specific form of the positive integral over some 1 over 2n plus 2. And we already know that this quantity must be positive because everything in the integrand is positive. But there's more than just the naive positivity here. So because this quantity they have this very special integral form, you're actually asking the following question. So suppose you have coefficients for different power of s, and you want to ask if they can come from some integration of some spectral density times this factor. Then this is just the moment problem that's well studied by mathematicians. It's essentially asking whether a sequence of numbers can be the moments from of a positive Borel measure. And depending on the support of your measure here, or equivalently the support for your spectral density, the moment problem is solved. They are solved and they have a criteria depending on which support that you're looking at. So I'll discuss two cases in the following slides, but the message here is that we can have stronger constraints on the numbers M and here than just asking them to be non-negative. So without any assumption on the spectrum, other than the fact that the mass square must be non-negative for physical states, then it's equivalent to the moment problem where the support is the non-negative real numbers, because the moment variable is 1 over mass square, and it should be non-negative. And in this case, we know the necessary and sufficient condition for the moment problem to have solution, and it can be stated in the following way. So given an infinite sequence M, you want to test for moment feasibility, then you form these two Hankel matrices and you test if they are positive semi-definite. That's all. If they are, then you have solution to your moment problem. This is for the case where you have an infinite sequence coming from coefficients in front of each power of S. If you don't have an infinite sequence, say you truncate your measurement at some finite derivative order, then you have some finite Hankel matrices. In that case, it might not be sufficient to have uh, you, just by using those conditions to have a solution to your moment problem. So it would be sufficient when both of the metrics here are non-singular, meaning they are actually positive definite instead of just positive semi-definite. But if one of the metric, the Hankel matrices here is singular, then you can find counterexamples where this the sequence satisfy both conditions, but still fail to have a moment, positive measure that give those whose moment give those numbers. And one in that case, one need an extra range condition, which is discussed in the paper by Crito and Falco. I'll not go into detail here because we'll not be using them, but it's worth noting. And the example usage of this moment criteria is the following. So let's take the Mass's superstring amplitude that we write down before, and let's gather the coefficients coming from the four limit. Then you have this zeta coefficient. Then if you gather them into this Hankel matrices form and the shifting Hankel matrix, then you can directly verify that they're indeed positive semi-definite, or actually positive definite here. And so that's in general how you would use the moment criteria. You just compute the, you just get the Wilson coefficients from some specific Mendelstein variable, from some specific monomials of Mendelstein variables, and you take and form the Hankel matrix of it. So that is without any assumption on the physical spectrum. If your spectrum has a mass gap, so all the exchange state should be above some mu gap, then we can have a stronger constraint on the Wilson coefficient. So with a loss of generality, let's set this mass gap score to be one. Then the moment, the criteria for existence of a positive measure that give those numbers is that it's the same of the Steel-Chess moment. Oh, by the way, the previous case of moment problem is called the Steel-Chess moment problem. And here it's the Hausdorff moment problem, it's just names. So the criteria for this kind of moment problem is the same of a Steel-Chess moment problem plus one extra condition where the Hankel matrix minus the shifted Hankel matrix must also be positive semi-definite. And so from this criteria, it's clear that it's stronger than the Steel-Chess. Also, it's also clear from just from the definition of moment problem. But in this case of bounded support from a moment variable, there's actually a more convenient way to characterize the conditions. So let's introduce this difference operator, which acts on the sequence of numbers that we're trying to determine if there exists a positive measure, positive representative measure or not. Then the criteria here is the same as this criteria, where you take the alternating difference on the moment sequence that you want to test, and it should be non-negative at every entry for every n that you look at. So this has been noted by several in several reference, and it's also straightforward to use the same example as in the previous page, and then you just form the alternating difference at different order to verify that every number here will be positive. So we see that because of the mathematical properties of the moment problem, you can say something about the Wilson coefficients other than just saying that they are non-negative. Now, we want to revisit the Gegenbauer positivity because we know that in principle, the Gegenbauer positivity is another set of constraint that you can implement in your on your Wilson coefficients. So for our dispersion relation, we know that the Wilson coefficient in our derivative expansion is obtained through this integral over the over a positive measure with the integrated variable mass square and the spin of the exchange. And then you are taking the derivative of this at the four limit, and after that you set t to be zero. So this from this expression, if you just set q to be zero and consider varying k, then you just get the moment constraints from the previous page. On the other hand, we can think about looking at the operators of the same total mass dimension, but with varying degree of t derivative, meaning that we are looking at the terms with the same total Mendelstam dimensions. Then if you look at the expression for these guys, you realize that they all have the same dependence on the moment variable. So that can be factored out, and you're left with a positive integral over vectors that are just numbers. So those V0, V1, V2 are the expansion coefficient of the Lejeune polynomial that I listed here. So they're just numbers and we know them. So in this way, you have a positive cone of infinite number of vectors, infinite because the spin here are unconstrained. So in principle, you can have contribution from every spin. And you're trying to look at what's the positive, what's the most general, what's a region for the most general positive linear combination of them. And if you include spin up to some number and plot it out numerically, you'll see that it actually actually carve out some region, some proper subset of the A for zero non-negative space. So this we know from the zeros order four limit, but by expanding around four limit, you see that you have stronger constraint than just that. But this numerical result is not very reliable because, as I said, to plot a region like this, you include spin up to some finite number. But it's possible that for some very high spin, you can have a vector pointing in some wrong direction. Then you are forced to include the region from your old boundary all the way to this spin because you have to take the most general positive linear combination. So you have to determine the boundary for all spins that includes all spins at once in order to have a definite set of bounds. And fortunately, the boundary structure of this polytope is particularly simple. It actually belongs to the so-called cyclic polytopes. So a cyclicity is a spatial property of polytopes. There are many ways to say to describe the cyclicity. And here, in the three-dimensional case that we're plotting here, let's just say that the boundary of the resulting polytope are given by adjacent spins here. So by proving cyclicity of this polytope, you already know about all the boundaries and you don't have to worry about any very, very high spin boundaries that you didn't include in your numerical computation because each of these boundaries will be non-redundant. And also there won't be anything lying outside of those boundaries. So in the three component example that we've been using, we can actually find the complementary description to this kind of adjacent spin boundary. We can instead find the normal vector to those adjacent spin boundaries. Then the Gegenbauer positivity is just that your Wilson coefficient vectors dotted into each of those vectors should be non-negative. And this is how we capture the Gegenbauer or the Lejeune positivity. So it seems very magical that Gegenberg polytope satisfy this so-called cyclicity, but in practice, it's not very hard to see that because in the case where you have in the three-dimensional case, you can think of the adjacent spin condition as the following: if you're claiming that the boundary of your polytope are captured by adjacent spin boundaries, then this means for each of the adjacent spin set, every other vertex must lie on the same side of that plane. So that's what we're trying to compute directly. And it's the same as forming a big matrix of those that collects those vectors. And you look at the minors, or actually the order minors of that matrix, and you require the order minors to be non-negative. This will ensure that every other spinning vector will lie on the same side of this plane, and the same for every pair of adjacent spin guys. So it goes roughly like this. It's included in an appendix in our paper, and so we know because those coefficients are just the Taylor coefficients of the Gegenbauer or Lejeune polynomial. We know its form. It can be written using the Pochhammer symbol. And the determinant you can write using this way where there is some positive prefactor times another determinant that depends on the spin, and delta here depends on the dimension, space time dimension there we're looking at. And this last factor is crucial because it's only the only place that something negative can come from is here. But it can, if we look at this term more carefully, we know that there must be a factor of product of Li minus Lj in this term, because if you exchange the spin of the if it exchange two spin in the order minor, it must give you a negative sign. And if you set two of the columns to be of the same spin, it must be zero. That's just the property of the determinant. And also we have this symmetry for the Pochhammer symbol, which basically tells you that if you form this product, A minus one, it's the same as minus, so you can take the negative, you can take the negative for each of the guys. So the left hand side is this, the right hand side is just this. So it's a simple relation. But by using this Pochhammer symbol identity, you can translate this into another factor that you know must be present in this determinant. But by power counting of the spins and the delta, you know that this must be the final answer for the determinant here, and it's manifestly positive. So this concludes the proof for the cyclicity of the Gegenbauer polynomial, and you can prove things for other orthogonal polynomials. They also enjoy this property in a similar way. So for general dimensions, the boundary structure of the cyclic polytope is also simple, although it's not as simple as in the three-dimensional case where we can visualize and just say that it's given by adjacent spin. In higher dimensions, it's still given by adjacent spins, but because you're in the higher dimensions, the boundary should come from a set of bigger number of spins. So you should include different pairs of adjacent spins in this way. And the positivity condition from Gegenbauer positivity will be that this determinant should be positive if your X, vector X, is to stay inside the polytope. So as an example, let's consider a vector in the four-dimensional case or projectively three-dimensional. And then you also enforce the permutation invariance. For example, this may come from identical scalar scattering. Then by using this relation, you can show that the coefficient must lie within this region. That's a proper subset of the first quadrant. And that's for the scalar case where you use the Lejeune polynomial. For the spinning case, the Lejeune polynomial are replaced by the so-called Wigner D matrices. And the Wigner D matrices are just the expectation value of this rotation operator of those cats that contains the information about the spin of the particle that's being exchanged and the difference of in helicity of the external particles on both sides. So this will be our polynomial basis to expand on. And you can similarly consider an expansion of it. And you also have the cyclic polytope in the case of the spinning polytope. So you know about the boundaries and you can form similar set of constraints. It's worth noting here because for the spinning case, we have different helicity configurations. Whereas for the scalar case, you just have a momentum. Here, there will be many choices of helicity configurations that we can make. Some of them will give you the same result, similar result as that of the scalar case, while some of them will produce some alternating sign that will bring your positive polytope structure. So in the first version of our paper, there was some error regarding this point, and it's currently pointed out by Svibern, Dimitris, and Alexander Zhubodov. So we corrected in the second version. So up till now, I only talk about something that's of this form, where you have a Gegenbauer polynomial or Lejeune polynomial divided by times the propagator and some positive coefficient. But we also know that there can also be U-channel contribution when you try to compute the derivative expansion of your amplitude. And those U-channel contribution will have a slightly different form of the Gegenbauer coefficients and also the moment coefficients. Although they are slightly deformed, they're still cyclic polytope because cyclicity is a combinatorial statement. And if you just do a general linear transformation on the vertices that form a cyclic polytope, it's still going to be a cyclic polytope. But if you combine the contribution from different channels, then the resulting region coming from the positive span of those vectors will not necessarily be cyclic. So let's look at some examples here. So for example, let's take this configuration. Let's neglect this. And let's consider spin one particle scattering. Then because you can separately compute the spinning polynomial contribution to your polytope, you have this U vertices, which are labeled in by red dot here. And you also have those vertices from S channel contribution, which are labeled by purple dot here. Maybe I should purple dot here. And you see that, for example, this guy is actually inside the convex hull of other spins, meaning that it's not on the boundary and your boundary will not include it. Furthermore, there will be some mixed boundaries that involves spins coming from different channels. So this boundary here in particular is a boundary that says your X when dotted into the boundary formed by 2U. And 2s must be non-negative. So this is a mixed boundary. But one nice thing about this this resulting polytope is that based on our observation of the numerical results, it seems that most of the individual cyclic boundaries from S polytope and U polytope are still retained when you form this Minkowski sum of two polytopes. It's only at those lower spins that some boundaries might be eaten or some new mixed boundaries might be formed. So there's not a known analytic proof of this point, and it's interesting to think about this more in the future, but right now this is just from our observation. So we discussed that you can have a set of constraints coming from the moment problem and another set of constraints coming from the cyclicity property of the Gegenbauer or the Gegenbauer polytope or the D matrices. Now, those two are you can think of those two as families of constraints along different direction. And if you have access to the Wilson coefficients for many monomials, then you can actually combine the constraints that comes from the positive polytope and also the Mohmer problem into a single constraint where, because when you dotted those Wilson coefficients into the walls of Gegenbauer polytopes, it must be positive. But the resulting vector formed by this must also satisfy the moment criteria, the moment sequence criteria. So if you take the Hankel matrix and shift the Hankel matrix and take the determinant again, then it should still be positive semi-definite. So this is the full S-channel EFT hadron condition. The SU EFT hadron will be slightly more complicated due to the fact that the Gegenbauer polytope are deformed and they're not cyclic. So you have slightly complicated walls, and also you have different kind of moment criteria for that. I'll discuss that later. So this condition that combines the moment and the Gegenbauer polytope are always, these two conditions are always necessary for scalar amplitudes that has physical spectrum in the S channel, meaning it satisfies moment problem, and also the residue comes from the spinning exchange. But it's not clear if the conditions here are instead sufficient to ensure the existence of such a measure, because so this statement we didn't investigate in our paper, but we can form an analogy to another well-known mathematical problem where if you consider a two-dimensional matrix instead of a one-dimensional sequence, and then you form a so-called bivariate moment problem where along the rows of this matrix, you ask the sequence to be moments of some moment variable, and along the columns, you ask it to be the moment sequence of another moment variable. You would think that maybe it's enough just to enforce the moment criteria along both directions. But it's actually shown that this is not sufficient to ensure the your moment matrix have a solution as a moment problem. So the case we have here is very similar, because along one direction you have moment, along another direction you have cyclicity, and cyclicity can be recast in the form that is basically a moment problem. So we are suspecting that it might not be enough to just naively require nested conditions in two separate direction. So we leave that for future investigation, but let's just say that this is necessary, but probably not sufficient. So in the previous page, we discussed the full EFT hadron condition for for the case where you only have S channel contribution. If you include the U channel contribution, then the coefficient is slightly deformed for moment problem because of the expansion of both S channel and U channel propagator. And those coefficients will not be universal for each order. Sorry?
Yes, come on.
All right. So,
sorry, I was not muted. Sorry, my problem.
Okay. So the coefficient in front of each order, each variable in your each order in your moment program will not be the same. That means that you cannot just pull them out and have the usual moment program. And what's worse is that this coefficient in front of your moment term here are actually they can actually come in either both positive and negative sign. So it might not make sense to ask what's the positive cone formed by these kind of vectors, because some of them can actually be negative and you can probably cover the whole space. But actually you can do something that transforms this expression into something that's still a positive sum of some positive vectors. So it's done in this way. So you know that those vectors, they are coming from taking derivative of your S channel and U channel contribution. They should live inside the mixed polytope that we discussed several slides earlier. So it's this one. Your U should live inside here or on the boundary, in which case it will be zero. So if you take from the set of the walls of that polytope and you take any of them and you dot that ball into this particular vector here, you should produce some non-negative number, because that's a definition of the boundary for that polytope. And by doing so, if you dot W into both sides, you can transform this entry into some positive number. But it's only a wall for this entry, because for this one, you're looking at a different derivative order, so you have to use a different set of walls. But there is another very interesting observation in our paper, which is the fact that if you consider walls of increasing derivative order, then it appears that the walls of the higher derivative SU polytope actually contains the walls of the lower derivative ones. So this means that suppose the vector you have ends at some finite derivative order, suppose here, then the walls formed by those vectors here will actually enclose all of these vectors that comes from the lower derivative order. So this means if you consider the set of walls, wall vectors from the outermost wall here, and you dot both sides using this wall, then every number, every prefactor here in your moment program must be non-negative. So with this procedure, you transform your default moment program into something that's a positive sum of some positive numbers. And so it's very similar to the moment problem that we have a solution to. But there's still one issue, which is the fact that the positive numbers in front of different terms is still different. So that's after all what prevents us from deriving a condition for moment problem. So in this paper, we use somehow ad hoc procedure to go around this issue. So we can again consider this as families of moment problems parameterized by those numbers. So each set of the numbers will produce for you some finite region in your parameter space. And if you look at the moment curve in this form, then it's possible that if you take alpha tilde to be some large enough number, it will actually encapsulate all possible regions that's generated by positive cones of moment vectors in this form. So in order to check whether this works or not, you still plug in those numbers into the moment curve defined by this 1x and alpha tilde x squared. So the Hankel matrix will be like this. And we try to find whether does there exist an alpha tilde that's large enough alpha tilde such that this is always positive for non-negative alpha L2, alpha L4, alpha L6, etc. and there is this what that's what observe what we observe is some a lower derivative order. So by transforming the moment-Hermite in this way, we still have a Hankel matrix-like condition for the deformed moment problem, although a little bit ad hoc. But there's one thing that I should be paying attention, which is the fact that we said before we're using the walls from Gegenbauer polytope or spinning polytope to transform the moment coefficients into some non-negative number, but there will always be some vector that when dotted into the wall that will give you zero, because the walls are given by the convex hull of the outermost, meaning the outermost vectors, meaning the coefficients with the highest derivative order. But by the definition of the boundary or the walls, there must exist some vector that lies on some set of walls. Otherwise, there won't be the boundaries. If this is not true, if you cannot find any U that satisfy this, then you can always shrink your boundary slightly. So that's a problem, because if you have a coefficient which is zero in your moment problem, then you can never find a non-trivial solution to the previous deformed moment variable that you're trying to use. So the way around this problem is that you enlarge your set of walls even further. So before I said that the set of walls for the mixed polytope will enclose each other. This comes from the A derivative and B 10 derivative. There will be some largest wall. But because some vectors will actually lie on this largest wall, it will produce for you some zero entry. So you just enlarge the outermost wall a little bit further. Then everything will be positive because they will be in the bulk of that. Every vector will be in the bulk of the resulting wall. And this, the extent that you're trying to enlarge the outermost wall will be a parameter that you can vary. So as an example of this very complicated and ad hoc manipulation, let's consider the Wilson coefficients here, where you have the zeroth order and second order derivative from t. Then let's define this. Then we know that the beta satisfy the mixed Gegenbauer positivity coming from the same derivative order result. We also know that the zeroth order guy satisfy the usual Hankel positivity.
Sorry, maybe can I ask a question again?
Yes, please.
We are again doing derivatives in the forward limit, right?
Yes.
I'm again confused, and we are scattering massless particles.
Yes.
So again, I'm a bit puzzled. I thought these were divergent. What is the physical quantity that we are constraining? Is the space of what's the definition of this is? Because if they are infinite.
So maybe let me address your question regarding the masses thing. So previously we said that we're trying to form a dispersion relation around the origin that gives you the s to the n factor times some order of t in your derivative expansion, right? But in the masses case, in the case where you have masses loop, you might have branch cut all the way to your origin, right? So this means that this description of the dispersion relation is no longer, you should not trust it in the case where you include this kind of message running. So the way to deal with this is that you actually deform your dispersion relation so that your pole, so before your dispersion relation looked like something like this. This is a contour around origin and s to the n plus one power, some fixed order, some fixed t. Now, because you know that the origin is potentially not safe if you include the masses cut, you deform it so that you're picking up the contribution away from the origin. By doing so, you're basically shifting the masses pole, in your contour integral to some non-zero position. And then you can similarly deform the contour so that you pick up the discontinuity across the branch cuts and residues of your UV amplitude. But the point is that in that case, because you already shift the definition of the coefficients, the four limit are not the same four limit as the unregulated case. So the masses running won't be a trouble for you, but you have to look at different kind of coupling there. You can think about, as I said, mentioned in the beginning of this talk, you can think about this, you can think of this EFT hedron as a toy model EFT hedron whose external states are masses. But the calculation only includes the massive spinning particles as internal states. You're of course correct by unitarity alone, that there should be masses particle running in the loop. And this will produce a masses branch cut for you. And in this case, you will have to start from the beginning, use a different kind of definition for your IR coefficients. You will try to have a bound on.
And maybe let me ask a different question. So one constraint that we often impose is that the imaginary part in the forward limit is positive. And that one is often okay even with cuts, because it's infrared fine. If it's infrared finite, then it's okay. Would you be able to construct other quantities like imaginary part of T that are also positive, that are like the derivatives of the imaginary part, but defined more carefully such that they are not infinite, like because
yes, it's precisely the regulated quantity here.
And the that quantity you say it's positive for any m. Of course, it doesn't reduce to the derivative when m equal to zero, I guess, because that derivative is divergent. So I hope that's not the case. So is it positive, but is it a difference of two things that are both very big and one is very positive, one is very negative, or is it? Is it a useful constraint? Should I impose this on the S matrix of pi n's? Say, can I say that the S matrix of pi n's obeys this, that these generalized derivatives of the S matrix of pi n's at forward scattering are positive? Can I impose this or no? Because I have then to put qualifiers about what flows, what not flows, blah, blah, blah. And then in practice, I cannot use.
I think after you form a regulated dispersion relation, you can indeed enforce the same Hankel matrix condition without any deformation. Of course, if you include both S and U channel contribution, then you have to use the deformed version of the moment condition. But the statement is that if you use the mass regulated dispersion relation and consider only S channel scattering, then you can indeed use the same Hankel condition and the Gegenbrock condition that I talked about.
But then nature doesn't know how to use only the S part of the amplitude or how to drop massless states. How do I convert this then to physical unregulated quantities that experimentalists measure, like the phase shifts, derivatives of the phase shift and stuff like this? Because if I put a regulator, but then the result is finite only because I put a regulator, is there a simple way of removing it? So the first Wilson coefficient, maybe it's always more or less fine. At most you have a log.
Yeah, right.
It's easy to disentangle. But when you start discussing like this fifth or sixth Wilson coefficient, they are so high in the expansion. How physically can you imagine getting physical constraints on amplitudes or something? Because I would imagine that's the goal, right? It's to carve out the space of low energy observables. But
Yes.
If you don't... But this regulator is not there. So what do you do?
Because this regulation is kind of fictitious, I I think you should be able to find some ratio of the bounds that does not depend on this fictitious regulator. It's not, we didn't discuss how different message regulators produce for you something that you have rule for in your observable. This discussion is kind of preliminary. It's only to show in the message case where in the message case, if you still want to use the same discussion we discussed earlier for the massive exchange, you can do this kind of regulation. Surely this fictitious mu must correspond to some choice of some transformation that maps the physical observable to the thing that you can bound. But we didn't explore how that map or dictionary actually works. So. Is there another question that I hear?
No, I just said, okay. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I mentioned that in this case where you still have the moment condition for the four limit coefficients, and you have the polytope condition for the same mass dimension coefficient, but based on the discussion that we say about the outermost wall, you have this EFT hedron condition, which is essentially a Hankel matrix condition of the coefficients that results from vectors dotted into the outermost wall. And it would be something like this. So the outermost wall is at -8 because you see those Gegenbauer polytopes are weaker for the higher derivative order. So you find the outermost wall and you deform the wall slightly so that every vector is inside the bulk of the wall, not on the boundary. Then nothing will vanish and you have this kind of bound that involves the ratio of the ratio of the Wilson coefficients in your theory. So a summary for what I talked about today, I missed a lot of points in our paper because it would be too long to discuss all of them. So I guess the important point is that those kind of polytope structure arise naturally when you consider expanding around the polynomial basis of your your residue has a natural expansion on. And the positivity of the spectral density will translate into some requirements to have the moment will be translated into moment feasibility requirements, and it's not long known by mathematicians to have some specific criteria to determine whether there exists a measure or not for these problems. And if you consider constraints from both polytope and moment problem, then you end up with some region that is well defined, and it's necessary for the coefficient that you get from our effective field theory to live in this space, because along each direction, it's simply the moment criteria and the polytope constraint. But it's not known whether this region that we call EFT hedron in our paper is really sufficient. And finally, in the later part, which is quite chaotic, I discussed the U-channel contribution, how U-channel contribution can change the story about the Gegenbauer polytope and also the moment criteria, namely the Hankel positivity constraint. You can still do that, but right now there is no analytic proof of many things that we stated. For example, the boundary of the mixed polytope and also the deformed moment curve. So it would be desirable to have an analytic proof, as in the case of S-channel constraints. And that would be for future work. So my talk stops here. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Any more questions for Tsu-chan?
Yeah, I have a question, but it's rather technical. So I would like to wait till the end. Okay, so there's no other question. But can I ask, can you show me again, how would you define this regularized derivative at t equal to zero? I mean, you sketched it, but it was in red and it was in the dark blue background. I could not see very well.
Oh, you mean like here?
Yeah, what is the regulated first derivative of the amplitude at t equal to zero that's positive? What is that quantity? Can you write just an equation?
Okay, so the regulated quantity should be something like this. So let's call this n zero at some defined as some mu square, which is basically the n square plus mu four to the
zero. Okay, so you put at zero. So let me understand, sorry. So this is, so this is not about derivatives in T. You are putting T equal to zero. This is about derivatives in S.
Yes, because of the problem I mentioned about the masses cut. So having masses cut essentially means that anything around your origin should be affected by the cut. So the regulated coefficient will be something that's defined away from the origin.
But I thought this was the regulated derivative with respect to S at t equals zero, not derivative with respect to T.
So could you repeat your question again about, I thought the math.
So the imaginary part of the amplitude at t equals zero is the optical theorem, right? It's positive.
Right.
Okay, that's it. Now, the derivative of the imaginary part at t equals zero, if you formally write the amplitude as some Gegenbauers and so on, like you did, it looks like it's positive because the derivatives of the Gegenbauers are positive, right? Mm-hmm. And so you are summing positive things, so it looks positive. But the problem is that it's divergent. It's infrared divergent, right? Almost always. Mm-hmm. At least if you take enough derivatives at t equals zero, you get divergence. So I thought you were saying that there is another way of thinking about these forward limits that is not divergent.
Yes, I think
here you are just putting t equals zero. You are not even expanding in t. It's even stronger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So maybe I didn't hear the full question clearly. So here before I was responding with the fact that if you define it this way, you can have the usual moment criteria, because now you can form something like this: a 2 0 mu square, a 4 0 mu square. That's for your moment criteria, and it's well defined. If you in addition want to talk about Gegenbauer positivity, of course you have to regulate the t also, because as you said, a derivative around t equals zero is problematic. So yeah. I said you might have to replace the derivative with a similarly regulated quantity around t.
Okay, you did not do it. It's something you would have to think on the fly.
Yeah, we have to think
about it. No, then forget about it. Yeah. Thank you.
So if there are no more questions, we can thank the speaker again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your invitation.